This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Tehran warns Israel it will hit Israeli cities and missile bases if Tel Aviv makes a mistake by carrying out its military threats against Iran. UN Human Rights Committee says Italy failed to save more than 200 refugees on a boat which sank in the Mediterranean Sea in 2013. And Britain announces new tougher border measures to stop the latest variants of COVID-19 from entering the country. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Iran has warned Israel it will hit Israeli cities and missile bases if Tel Aviv makes a mistake by carrying out military threats against Tehran.
Israelis must know that if they make the slightest mistake, the cities of Tel Aviv and Haifa will be razed to the ground on the basis of remarks made by the leader of the Islamic Revolution. Based on the strategies of the Islamic Republic, the collapse of Israel is on the agenda. Iran and regional nations will not back down on their demand for the collapse of Israel. There is no way other than ousting the cancerous tumor of Israel from the region.
Abbas Shekarchi made the remarks after an Israeli general said that the regime is refreshing operational plans against Iran. The Iranian military official dismissed Aviv Kochavi's remarks as an illusion and psychological warfare. He noted that such remarks could also be based on the fact that Israel is not aware of Iran's military might. The latest Israeli rhetoric against Iran comes as the new U.S. administration has signaled that it wants to re-enter the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Tel Aviv has frequently threatened the Islamic Republic with strikes over its nuclear program. Political commentator Mustafa Khoshesh says the U.S. and Israeli threats against Iran are hollow and boastful.
Now, after triple incidents last year, shooting down the global hawk, and especially the masterpiece, which was Iranian missile attack on Amal Assad, when the commander-in-chief of the United States, President Donald Trump, threatened to strike back 52 Iranian centers, and he never did that, then their hollow and boastful threats proved to be empty, hollow completely, without any credibility. So what should Biden do in order to advance this containment strategy? They have asked, at least for the past 1 year, they have asked the Israelis to step forward and to help them through posing threats to Iran, military threats to Iran, in order to claim that, okay, if crazy Donald Trump is gone, now the crazy Netanyahu is still there, and he would go for the military threats. But in essence, all throughout the last one and a half years, what have they been doing? They have been claiming that they've been striking Iran in Syria. 95% has been no more than lies. But for the 5% they did something to Iranian allies, they have surely received their response. The Israelis remember pretty well what happened to them in the Golan Heights, and they remember the number of casualties they had in there.
The U.S. has temporarily frozen planned arms sales to the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia for review. A State Department spokesperson said moves aimed at ensuring sales meet Washington's strategic objectives with regard to its partners. Frozen deals include a $23 billion package of F-35 fighter jets to the United Arab Emirates. Former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration agreed to the deal after the UAE normalized relations with Israel. U.S. has also been preparing major sales of munitions to Saudi Arabia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in his Senate confirmation session that the Saudi onslaught on Yemen has contributed to a dire humanitarian situation in the country. And joining us now, Adam Malloy, for more on the story is Brian Terrell, political commentator. Hello, Brian. Your thoughts on this new administration and the way, I mean, is it going to go possibly beyond just a simple review in your mind, or you think it's going to be just that, just a review?
Well, I think this is very positive change that we have a president now who understands that the COVID-19 pandemic and climate change are real things, need to be dealt with. But what we're seeing is a return to normal, and as reassuring as that might be, we need to remember how bad normal was, and that this war in Yemen began under the Obama administration when President Biden was vice president of the United States. I'm concerned over Secretary Blinken's saying that it's advances to our strategic objectives that this review is going to be based on, and not consideration for the people of Yemen who are facing humanitarian disaster that Mr. Blinken is talking about as well. This is, in the United States, the big arms manufacturers like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, they don't just follow U.S. policies, they make them. In reply to this, a couple days ago when this was beginning to be talked about, the CEO of Raytheon, Greg Hayes, said this. He said, look, peace is not going to break out in the Middle East anytime soon. I think it will continue to be an area where we will see solid growth in weapon sales. The weapons manufacturers are still confident in that. The weapons sales to Israel will be continuing. Our strategic objectives are not the objectives of what's going to make life on planet Earth continue to be possible. It's going to be about what the investors and these big arms corporations are what's going to continue to be driving it, and what's been driving U.S. foreign policy for many years through different administrations.
So then this whole, opting to review this, basically these deals with the Saudis, with the UAE, you even mentioned even under Obama they're selling tons of munitions to the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates. So my ultimate question, is it just political theatrics, or do you really think that they might actually hold up the F-35 fighter jet deal, 50 of them, to the United Arab Emirates?
Well, I hope that's held up. There still are, the F-35 is a weapon that is not needed anywhere. The United States doesn't need to have them. We don't need to be selling them to Israel. We don't need to be selling them to the UAE or to anyone. It's a very destabilizing weapon. I'm really afraid that that if they're not going to be sold to the United Arab Emirates, they'll be sold to somebody else. The United States needs a real reversal. I'm very concerned about with this return to normalcy. Mr. Biden, Secretary Blinken, the new Secretary of Defense as well, are talking about America is back and America is going to be the leader again. And I think it's incumbent on people who want peace and want the stability of the world to be, as American citizens, we have to be working toward making the United States a humbler, smaller partner in the world and not calling the shots. It should not be, the United States should not be the number one weapons manufacturer and merchant in the world.
Even if it shouldn't be, Brian, but it is. You very well know it is, and it's big,
yes,
big, and it's huge business there. And considering that Joe Biden, he put forward two executive orders, one canceling that pipeline from Canada to the States, and also that controversial pipeline, what was it called, the XL pipeline or whatever, and he also signed another one shutting down private prisons in America, trying to go after racial inequalities there. Well, guess what? That's resulted in tons of jobs being lost and a couple industries basically in those areas going belly up. Wouldn't it be too much at this point for him to go after the weapons industry?
Well, at the same time, the whole fracking industry getting natural gas out of shale is not going to be affected by this. I would like to see it, and I don't want to be hopeless. I do think there are some signs of progress, but it's not enough. I think the world's in trouble with the climate change and the danger of nuclear war. We are better off today than we were last month. We are in a situation that is normal, but we have to realize that normal was an emergency. We're returning to normal, but 8 years ago, 4 years ago, it was normal, and we were on the brink of disaster all the time. So yes, a sigh of relief that things are normal, but we cannot rest on that. We have to realize that if the Biden administration is going to be going forward on these things, it's going to have to be because there's pressure from the American people. Is we have to impress upon our government that our strategic advantage is not being in charge of things and not being that you're not taking the resources from the world and not be selling weapons to the countries that somehow fit our strategic objectives.
All right, stay safe. Thanks for joining us, Brian, with your input there. From Alloia, Iowa, Mr. Brian Terrell, political commentator.
Thank you.
You bet. A coalition of rights groups and NGOs have threatened France with legal action over racial profiling by the country's police against people of color and ethnic minorities. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and four other groups have warned that they will file a class action lawsuit. They've given the French authorities 4 months to act to end what they called systemic discrimination by police or face legal action. In a 350-page warning letter, their group also called for a change in France's criminal code to explicitly ban discrimination during identity checks. The move comes amid mounting allegations of police racism, especially toward immigrants and people of color. In December, President Emmanuel Macron himself acknowledged about the problem of discrimination against people of African and Arab descent in France. The UN Human Rights Committee says that Italy failed to protect right to life of more than 200 refugees on a boat which sank in the Mediterranean Sea back in 2013. The committee said Italy failed to respond promptly to various distress calls from the sinking boat. It added that if Italian authorities had immediately dispatched coast guards, rescue would have reached the vessel just 2 hours before it sank at the latest. The UN body noted that Italy's delayed action had a direct impact on the loss of hundreds of lives. It urged Rome to conduct an independent and timely investigation to prosecute those responsible. The boat was carrying more than 400 adults and children from the Libyan port. 60 kids were among the people drowned. Joining us from Rome for an update on the story is Max Civili. Hello, Max. Hope you're safe and well out there. What can you tell us about the story?
Well, let me briefly recap what happened on October 10, 2013, when a boat which was carrying more than 400 adults and children, mostly Syrians, departed Zuwara, a fishing port in Libya. A few hours after the departure in international waters, the boat was shot at by a vessel flying above a flag, and as a result, water started to flood the boat. They were about 100 kilometers away from the Italian island of Lampedusa. One of those on board the boat called Italian authorities several times, but these distress calls were redirected to Malta, which was over 200 kilometers away. By the time a Maltese patrol boat arrived, the boat carrying the refugees had capsized, and as you said before, more than 200 refugees died. The United Nations Human Rights Committee said that the refugees' boat was in international waters within Malta's search and rescue zone, but a timely response by the Italian authorities might have averted the tragedy. And the Human Rights Committee also called on Italian authorities to proceed with an independent and timely investigation and to prosecute, of course, those responsible for the death. A parallel claim brought against Malta was rejected by the committee, as the plaintiffs did not bring legal proceedings before courts in Malta, which is basically one of the requirements prior to filing the case to the Human Rights Committee. And as we all know, the Central Mediterranean route is described by the United Nations High Commission of Refugees as the most dangerous migration route in the world. Since 2014, more than 20,000 20,000 refugees have died at sea while trying to reach Europe from Africa. And while many have drowned at sea, thousands have been intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard, returned to Libya, where they end up in detention, often in horrific conditions. And the Libyan Coast Guard is financed, equipped, and trained by the EU and some of its member states, including Italy. In essence, the Libyan Coast Guard consists of the country's warring militias, who abuse refugees and often trade them as slaves.
And Max, Italian authorities, what have they been saying about this throughout the last few years?
Look, you know, the migrant, the refugee issues is quite controversial here in Italy. You probably remember our previous domestic affairs minister, Interior Minister Matteo Salvini, who is the head of the right-wing populist League Party and is currently facing trial on charges of sequestration and abuse of power over the port closures. You probably also remember when he closed ports to vessels carrying migrants. Well, let me tell you, the situation has slowed down since the COVID crisis. We're not receiving as many migrants as in the past. On Monday, over 370 migrants were allowed to disembark on the island of Sicily after being rescued amid storms in the Mediterranean. The migrants were rescued by the Ocean Viking, a humanitarian vessel. The group rescued included 165 children, and most of them were unaccompanied, and there were also about 20 aged 4 or younger.
Wow. Okay, bud, take care. Stay safe. We'll talk to you soon from Rome. Max Civilli there updating us. And now Portugal has set a new record for coronavirus cases and deaths as Europe is struggling with the virus and its new variants. Portugal registered nearly 300 deaths and over 6,000 new infections. That's in the past day alone. This is a country that's been under lockdown since mid-January, with hospitals struggling to cope with patients. Now, the government has announced it will suspend all flights to and from Brazil for 2 weeks due to spread of new COVID variants. UK recorded its second highest death toll to date since the start of the pandemic, with over 1,700. Health authorities also logged over 25,000 new cases. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said his government will set out new tougher border controls to stop new variants from getting into the country.
We have also banned all travel from 22 countries where there is a risk of known variants, including South Africa, Portugal, and South American nations. And in order to reduce the risk posed by UK nationals and residents returning home from these countries, I can announce that we will require all such arrivals who cannot be refused entry to isolate in government-provided accommodation, such as hotels, for 10 days without exception.
Now, Britain's already tightened restrictions in order to curb spread of the coronavirus, but the country suffered a sharp rise in infections and deaths in recent weeks, fueled by new highly transmissible strain. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy has registered over 15,000 new cases and 467 more deaths. The country has logged over 86,000 deaths so far, second highest in Europe. It's also reported over 2.4 million cases to date. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Welcome to the futuristic world of facial recognition payment. It might sound like something from a science fiction movie, but this kind of transaction is already happening millions of times a day across China's major cities. With the technology now being introduced in the United States and other countries such as Denmark and Nigeria, are we all going to be using it within a few years' time? And are there data security and privacy issues that we should worry about? The article you're about to hear has been written by Richard Bainbridge. The piece is titled, Why Your Face Could Be Set to Replace Your Bank Card. Please stay with us for more of Richard Bainbridge's article. Sarah Stewart strolls into a small Mexican restaurant in Los Angeles, California, and orders a torta, a type of sandwich. To pay, she simply looks at her reflection in a small LCD screen attached to the cashier's counter. Then, to add her preferred amount of tip, she flashes a quick peace sign at the monitor. The entire process takes less than 5 seconds, and it's entirely contactless. Moreover, Sarah Stewart doesn't need to carry her mobile phone or bank card with her, or show any form of identification, or even enter a PIN number. Welcome to the futuristic world of facial recognition payment. It might sound like something from a science fiction movie, but this kind of transaction is already happening millions of times a day across China's major cities. With the technology now being introduced in the United States and other countries like Denmark and Nigeria, are we all going to use it within a few years' time? And are there data security and privacy issues that we should be concerned about? Sarah Stewart, an 18-year-old university student, says she has no such concerns. She says, I feel like technology is moving so fast that people don't even think twice about using something like this. She says, our phones already read our faces, and our faces already all over the internet, so I don't think it really makes much of a difference to someone's security. It's faster, it's more convenient, and it's safer, and you don't have to worry about leaving your phone or cards at home. She uses facial recognition payment via a US technology startup called PopID. You sign up via its website by uploading a photograph of your face, which is stored on the firm's cloud-based system. You then link your account to your bank card. In addition, you can choose to use PopID's hand gesture tipping tool. Sarah Stewart has set this at thumbs up for 10%, the peace sign for 15%, and a shaka or hand loose sign for 20%. PopID is based in Los Angeles, California, and is now used by about 70 independent restaurants and cafes across a handful of U.S. cities, mainly on the west coast of the United States. The firm's chief executive, John Miller, says, our view is that using your face to pay is no different than using your phone. John Miller says, it's just another way to identify yourself. The digital picture taken at point of sale is destroyed immediately, and the data isn't shared with anyone. In fact, he argues that it's less intrusive than paying by your mobile phone, because a phone can track your location at all times via GPS or global positioning system. He adds that the photos stored by the PopID are mathematical maps of unique facial vectors, not actual photographs. Currently, PopID requires the user to temporarily lower his or her face mask, but the firm says it is updating its system so that this will not have to be done in the future. Some 7,000 miles away or 12,000 kilometers away in the Chinese city of Guangzhou, another student has facial payment technology on her mind. Ling, who did not wish to share her real name for fear of getting into trouble, says that it is now the only way to buy food from the vending machine in her accommodation block at Sun Yat-sen University in China. Unlike Sarah Stewart in Los Angeles, California, Ling in Guangzhou, China is far from happy about the rollout of the technology. Concerned about its ever-increasing encroachment into her daily life, she's refusing to use it, even if that means she cannot buy a late-night snack. She says, technology is like a tide. There's no way you can swim against it, but I also want to make a stand of some kind for as long as I'm able to do so. If technology in general is indeed a tide, then the rollout of facial recognition payment technology in China is something of a tsunami. Almost all 98% of mobile payments in China goes through just two apps: Alipay, owned by e-commerce giant Alibaba, and WeChat Pay, and both are racing to install their facial recognition systems across the country. Alipay is spending 3 billion yuan, or $420 million, over 3 years, and according to Chinese state media, 760 million people will be using facial recognition payments by next year. Wang Bing, from the Luoyang Vocational College of Science and Technology in Henan Province in China, says the rollout has been fueled by the coronavirus pandemic. He says, the experience of COVID was huge in China in terms of bringing people into facial recognition systems. He adds that the software and camera systems are so advanced that they are impossible to trick, such as by stealing someone's photograph. The technology can also differentiate between identical twins. But will the technology take off in the rest of the world? Brett King, an expert on the future of banking and payment systems, believes it will, unless governments choose to stop it. The author of a book called Banking 4.0 says that the exact measurements and features of your face are actually more secure than your account passwords. He says, "Facial payment is part of the growing digital identity structure. I appreciate the concerns about privacy, but the reality is that a face-based digital identity structure is inevitable for safety and security." He added, "Digital payments, digital transactions and services are becoming more and more embedded in our lives and in our world, and that's definitely going to require biometrics, because passwords are simply not secure enough." Brett King adds that many users of Apple phones are already happy to use facial recognition to access their handsets, and that the facial payment systems are just an extension of that. However, he says, US regulators may look at the technology. This comes at a time of increased concern about facial recognition systems in general. A handful of Democrats in US Congress want to try to reintroduce a bill this year to prevent the technology being used by federal agencies, such as the FBI, to identify crime suspects. Pop ID's John Miller says he's in talks with the main card payment processing companies. They are said to see facial recognition payment as a way of bypassing mobile phone apps, such as Apple Pay and Google Pay. John Miller says they don't want to be dependent on the phone, because Apple is one company that can threaten them. He added, "So the idea of moving the payment system straight from the card to the face is very appealing to them." Yet, John Miller admits that facial recognition payment is an idea that some will never accept. He says, "There's a segment of the population that's never going to adopt it, no matter how much logic you go through about how it compares to the mobile phone, because for them, it's just psychological."
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I told Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. We're talking about how we are able to deal with ourselves and the importance of making sure that we take care of our body, our spirit, our soul. And of course, just reminding you that we're on part one of the book, which is how to deal with yourself. And of course, then we go on to, inshallah, later on into part two, how you deal with others, how to deal with others. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, "Man katama al-atibba maradahu khana badana." Someone who conceals their sickness from doctors, they are indeed betraying their body. You know how I said that we have a responsibility, we have an obligation. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has entrusted this body to us as an amana, so we can't do with it as we wish. Absolutely not. We can't inflict any kind of harm onto it. We can't do something that we have no right to do. because it is an amana in our hand, our body, and also our soul. So the amana, we have to treat it in the best way possible. One of the ways of us preserving that amana and protecting that amana is by making sure that not only do we keep it away from illnesses, from sicknesses, but also we keep it towards the best means and the best possible treatment as much as we are able to. Of course, you know, when we're talking here about concealing, I'd just like to make point here. Later on, we're also going to be talking about how a person needs to make sure that they don't nag and complain about each and every sickness that they have. And concealing their sickness is also a good thing. But concealing it from who? You know, here we're talking about if you have a sickness, you need to make sure that you seek consultation and guidance from a professional, that you don't, you know, say, well, I'm going to bear with the sickness. I'm not going to talk to a specialist about any of this. That's the wrong kind of approach. I'd also like to share another hadith that Sheikh Jawadi also mentions here from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. That's also a kind of lesson for us. We go through different seasons throughout the year, and Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says that one way of us, you know, bringing about a kind of correct approach in our planning for the year as far as avoiding sickness and staying healthy, he says, توقعوا البرد في أوله وتلقوه في آخره. توقعوا البرد, which means that you should welcome, that you should protect yourself from the bird in the beginning. So when autumn comes, make sure that you dress as much as possible, that you keep yourself warm in the beginning of the cold season. وَتَلَقَّوْهُ فِي آخِرِهِ, and at the end of the cold season, entering into spring, for example, you should welcome it, that you should receive it. So don't wear that much warm clothing, for example. تَوَقَّوُ الْبَرْدْ فِي أَوَّلِهِ وَتَلَقَّوْهُ فِي آخِرِهِ فَإِنَّهُ يَفْعَلُ فِي الْأَبْدَانِ كَفِعْلِهِ فِي الْأَشْجَارِ. Because cold weather does to the body the same as it does to trees.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafati, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
أَوَّلُهُ يُحْرِقْ وَآخِرُهُ يُورِقْ. It starts off, so coldness does to a tree. Cold weather burns the tree, right? And that's why in autumn, you know, the leaves of tree fall. أَوَّلُهُ يُحْرِقْ وَآخِرُهُ يُورِقْ. And at the end of the season, when spring starts, leaves start to grow again. So that's exactly what's happening to a person's body. Into a person's body, when you are protecting yourself from the beginning of winter, you are protecting your body from it being affected by the cold weather. And then towards the end of the cold season, you are now receiving it and welcoming it by not wearing that much clothes. And of course, that's going to bring about, you know, a kind of positive sustainability, which is a good thing. وَآخِرُهُ يُورِقْ. يُورِقْ coming from the word وَرَقْ. وَرَقْ الشَّجَرْ, which means leaves. Now, talking about all of these things and speaking about how we are able to keep ourselves healthy and prevent from sicknesses. Again, here there's a hadith from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that speaks about تقليم الأظافر وأخذ الشارب, that you cut your nails and you shorten your moustache من جمعة إلى جمعة, from one Friday to another Friday. Well, later on we're going to have a special episode on, you know, what's recommended to do on Fridays. أمان من الجذام, that it is a safety from leprosy. Again, here we're talking about something as simple as cutting nails and it having an effect of keeping you secure and safe from certain sicknesses like leprosy. Or ترك العشاء مهرمة, that if you don't have dinner, it's going to lead you to become feeble and weak and of old age. وَيَنْبَغِي لِلْرَجُلِ إِذَا سَنَّ أَنْ لَا يَبِيتَ إِلَّا وَجَوْفُهُ مُمْتَلِئٌ مِنَ الطَّعَامِ, that an old person, when they reach a certain age of elderness, they should always try to make sure that their stomach is full of foods. وَالْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ وَصَلَاةُ وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَى سَيِّدِنَا مُحَمَّدٍ وَآلِهِ الطَّاهِرِينَ.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com www.ifa.org/en.
In the limelight.
The article you're about to hear under the heading Homeless Encampment Evictions Highlight the Cruelty of Capitalism Amid COVID has been written by Aziza Kanji, who is a legal scholar and writer based in Toronto, Canada. Aziza Kanji is a regular opinion contributor to Canadian and international media on issues relating to racism, law, and social justice. Stay with us for more of Aziza Kanji's article. Canada's homeless encampments, two faces of state brutality are on display. One is the organized abandonment that has relegated hundreds of thousands across Canada to homelessness at twice the rate as in the United States. The other is the organized violence that evicts homeless people from encampments erected in the shadow of the state's malign neglect. In Toronto, for example, Canada's largest and most unequal city, frontline workers estimate there are currently 1,000 to 2,000 people sleeping in dozens of encampments outdoors, several times more than the 400 acknowledged by city officials. Against the advice of the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on Housing, the municipality has been raising encampments in the name of safety and health, relocating people to institutional spaces that are far from healthy or safe. "Nobody cares about us," said Moss Park encampment resident Cassie. "It's like we're bedbug in their building and they just want to exterminate us." Even before the pandemic, Toronto's dangerously overcrowded shelter system was a petri dish for disease transmission, to quote longtime street nurse Kathy Crow. A study published recently in the Canadian Medical Association Journal found COVID-19 infection rates of 41.7% in one large Toronto shelter. In the city's shelter hotels, hotel is nothing but name, people report being uprooted from their support networks, required to room with strangers, and surprised with intrusive wellness checks. Since they are permitted to bring only two bags of possessions with them, many leave poorer than when they arrive. Meanwhile, in temporary respites, physical distancing is achieved by caging people in transparent glass boxes, whilst the lights have been left on for 24 hours a day. The imposition of such solutions to homelessness, without consulting homeless people themselves, exemplifies the state's violent benevolence, in which instrumental violence is narrated as gentle or non-violent, even when it's violent and is experienced as oppressive, in the words of anti-poverty scholar activist A.J. Withers and critical social work academic Chris Chapman. Even in the frigid temperatures of winter, many homeless people are deciding to sleep outside instead, or are forced to by the persistent shelter unavailability. Contrary to Toronto's claims of increased capacity during the pandemic, there are 1,158 fewer shelter spaces available this winter in Toronto as compared to last winter. 61% of requests received by the city for shelter are simply turned away. Many of the people sleeping in encampments know people who have died outside in the winter, social worker Kirsten Howard attested to Toronto City Council. I am asking you to consider how bad the system must be for them to prefer to take that risk than to deal with the inadequate shelter system. In apparent dissociation from this reality, city press releases applaud the extraordinary steps taken to help and protect people experiencing homelessness during COVID-19 pandemic. The Canadian government presents a menu of bad options, then expects gratitude for the crumbs dispensed. At its press release proclaim, Toronto consistently places at the top of international rankings due to investments championed by its government, residents and businesses. Left unmentioned is that these international rankings include being one of the most unaffordable cities in the world, having one of the largest super-rich wealth gaps in the world, and being the child poverty capital of a country that has one of the highest child poverty rates in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. Toronto spends almost five times more on policing than on shelter and housing. At the current legislated minimum wage, a worker would have to work 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, to affordably rent an apartment in Toronto. The waiting list for social housing is 7 to 10 years long. All levels of Canadian government have stripped funding for vital social goods like housing to the bone, while fattening institutions such as the military and the police. Even money ostensibly allocated for social welfare has in some cases turned out to be yet more police enrichment by another route. For example, 99% of the Ontario government's $200 million grant for community safety and well-being ended up back in police coffers. Meanwhile, in the disaster opportunism of the pandemic, the provincial government has further extended its own emergency powers for up to 2 years. While measures protecting those who rent from eviction have been ripped away. In fact, evictions have been further facilitated with the new perversely named Protecting Tenants and Strengthening Community Housing Act, known as the Evictions Act, by those on the receiving end of its protection. While corporate landlords have continued to reap large profit margins, impoverished tenants have been forced to beg for their homes in mass online eviction hearings, 7,000 in the month of November alone. These eviction hearings are a pipeline to encampments, observer and lawyer Dania Majid of the Advocacy Centre for Tenants Ontario said. In Toronto, 600 new people have been entering the shelter system every month, according to the city's own data, which has a pattern of understating the numbers to make the problem disappear, if only on paper. Having jettisoned the possibility of ensuring genuinely affordable housing and a livable wage, the state directs its resources towards penalizing the survival strategies of the dispossessed. The Ontario Superior Court has refused to suspend Toronto bylaws prohibiting people from sleeping in parks, maintaining that parks are public resources intended to be available and used by everyone, except apparently by homeless people, for activities necessary for life. As Brendan Jowett, one of the lawyers who brought the case, argues, what was really at stake was not whether people can use public parks for recreation, but whether people can use public parks without being reminded of the city's social ills. Even efforts to mitigate the state's public cruelty with private generosity have been disciplined. Carpenter Khalil Saveright was threatened by the city with legal action for constructing tiny shelters for people sleeping outside. With the expansion of pandemic policing powers, the burden of intensified harassment has been primarily by homeless people, indigenous peoples, and black people, the same shoulders on which the greatest share of police brutality has long been inflicted. In recent years, Toronto cops have been caught targeting homeless people with hefty fines for fabricating offences in order to increase their numbers after forfeiting a few days' pay. These police officers have been permitted back onto the beat, making $100,000 plus per year. The state traps homeless people in an impossible position. They are deprived of their housing, but prohibited from sleeping rough, sleeping in public places. They are denied public washroom and shower facilities, but punished for performing necessary bodily functions outside. A fundamental feature of the rule of law is that the law must be possible to obey. Instead of the rule of law, homeless people are subjected to the law of rule, crushed under the force of law's punishment, but excluded from its protection. Housing is a human right under international law, yet in Canadian, as in United States courts, this basic floor of human entitlement is treated as an unattainable ceiling. Instead of serving as a much-hoped-for portal to a more just future, the coronavirus pandemic has been a time warp, remolding old inequalities to fit the new reality. Wealthy corporations have been giving millions of dollars in government aid, while social assistance recipients living below poverty line have had their benefits clawed back. Settler squatters, corporations and governments appropriate indigenous lands with impunity, whilst homeless people are punished for sleeping in parks. The forms of violence involved in sustaining this unjust social order imperil public health. Environmental exploitation destroys biodiversity, enabling the emergence of new diseases. Evictions deprive people of their shelter, whilst telling them to shelter in place. Deportations force people to travel, facilitating viral spread. Police brutalization brings people into closer contact with police officers who aren't required to wear face masks. Mass incarceration exposes prisoners to mass infection. Racialization concentrates these harms in non-white communities, which, non-coincidentally, have suffered the pandemic's greatest toll. The coronavirus pandemic is a global reminder of what many have never been allowed to forget: the stifling inequality engendered by capitalism takes lives, sometimes quickly and very often slowly. With encampment evictions, the state punishes those being suffocated for gasping to breathe.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.